Good morning. This is Linda, and we're going to begin reading the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, May 16th, 2017. We're going to start with an article that's out of the local area titled Cat Ready to Pounce When Orders Arrive. It's written by Tony Reed, but actually came out of the New York City. Caterpillar Incorporated is getting ready to fire up production to meet the demand. It's gambling will get back on track eventually. Speaking to industry analysts recently in New York City, Caterpillar said it has to start the ramp-up process now to be ready when orders speed up. Amy Campbell, in charge of investor relations for Caterpillar, said there is a long road to climb, using Decatur production of massive mining dump trucks as an example. We built 1,700 large mining trucks at the peak of the production cycle more than 4 years ago, she told Wells Fargo 2017 Industrials Conference. And we sold 70 last year. You just don't get back to 1,000 in a few months. Campbell said Caterpillar is now huddling with its suppliers and its own factory managers to prepare production to accumulate inventory ready for when a sustained upswing in orders arrives. She said the aim was to smooth the way for a production increase without undue delays or having to splash lots of money on solving parts supply bottlenecks. It certainly there is a lot of work going on to avoid the mistakes of the past, Campbell said in the presentation, a recording of which is available on Cat's website. How confident is Caterpillar that good times are going to roll again? Its first quarter sales and revenues numbers released in April hit $9.8 billion, which blew past Wall Street predictions and was the first time in 2 years that same quarter sales and revenues rose. Caterpillar's Resource Industries division, which includes Decatur production, swung from a loss of $96 million in the first quarter of 2016 to a $158 million profit in the 2017 first quarter. Company-wide, Caterpillar raised full-year 2017 revenues to a range of $38 billion to $41 billion. Campbell said the outlook was a lot rosier, but Caterpillar, which still plans to spend $1.25 billion on restructuring costs in 2017, is not out of the woods yet. Commodity prices for mined production of anything from copper to iron ore are still showing some significant volatility, she said, and there are still a lot of parked mining trucks around the world gathering dust. But Caterpillar has seen a steady rise in parts sales, traditionally the first sign of a strengthening marketplace that usually sees such sales followed by orders for new vehicles. One of the reasons so many older trucks are staying parked could be that they have previously been cannibalized for parts to keep other trucks running and save money, she said. Campbell said Caterpillar had launched a study of what it calls the parts fleet to try to figure out what is going on and how many trucks are sitting gutted in parking bays. We have certain things we certainly know are going on, Campbell said, and a lot of those trucks have been cannibalized and won't go back into production. They've either taken too many parts or it's gotten too old to bring it back into full production. Caterpillar said that its own heavy cost-cutting has produced a leaner, more efficient company that will be able to produce higher profits with less expense when those miners finally pick up the phone to their local Cat dealer. Campbell's remarks come as the company is preparing for a cost-saving move that will benefit Decatur. Its planned closure of an Aurora plant will bring 500 jobs to Decatur. The move, which the company announced it was considering in January and confirmed on March 31st, will bring production of large wheel loaders and compactors to Decatur. Caterpillar has said it will move production of its medium wheel loaders to an Arkansas facility. The transitions are expected to be complete by the end of 2018. That completes that article. It's kind of exciting news. Next, out of Decatur, we're going to have Crime in Courts, and our article is presented by Tony Reed and headlined Victims' Identities Released in Three Separate Fatal Crashes. The identities have been released of a child and two adults who died after three separate traffic crashes in a harrowing 12 hours on Macon County roads. None of the crashes that took place between Sunday night and Monday morning were related. Police have said alcohol is suspected as a factor in one of the incidents. 17-month-old Ava M. Taliaferro of Decatur suffered fatal injuries in a head-on vehicle collision on Lost Bridge Road near Western Drive. She was pronounced dead in the emergency room of St. Mary's Hospital at 1:05 a.m., according to Macon County Coroner Michael Day. In the second unrelated accident, 60-year-old Franklin Mark Lynch Sr. was pronounced dead at 7:52 p.m. Sunday in the emergency room of Decatur Memorial Hospital. The Decatur man's vehicle struck a utility pole about 7 p.m. at the intersection of Martin Luther King Drive and Grand Avenue, police said. Autopsy results showed no signs of trauma or significant injury, Day said, meaning the Decatur man's death was not caused by the crash. Toxicology and other laboratory tests to determine the cause of the death were pending. In the third incident, Kenneth Plesser, 28, of Gary, Indiana, was pronounced dead at 3:35 a.m. Monday in the Decatur Memorial Hospital emergency room. Day said Plesser suffered massive injuries when he was struck by both a semi-truck and a car as he walked in the roadway about 2:48 a.m. on US 51, just north of Hampshire Road near Maroa. Day said Plesser had gotten out of his nearby parked vehicle for an unknown reason. In the case of the crash that claimed Ava Taliaferro's life, Decatur Police Sergeant Steve Hagemeyer said it appeared the 30-year-old driver of the car she was in was impaired by alcohol. Preliminary investigation showed that the man's eastbound vehicle crossed the center line and collided with a westbound pickup truck at 12:22 a.m. The car driver was hospitalized with injuries, and police said the pickup driver later took himself to hospital for treatment. The crash remains under investigation by the Decatur Police Fatal Accident Investigation Team. Charges had not been filed Monday night as the investigation continued, police said. The Macon County Sheriff's Office on Sunday evening also arrested a 25-year-old Downs man after two non-injury crashes and a police chase. The suspect, Cody Riddle, faces preliminary charges that include driving under the influence. Police said he struck a vehicle near the intersection of MacArthur Road and Ash Avenue in Decatur, then left the scene and traveled north on US 51, crashing into an SUV and a minivan before continuing north. Riddle was arrested just south of the DeWitt County line. Macon County Sheriff Thomas Snyder said the spate of accidents underscore the hazards of road travel. He said those dangers are made infinitely worse by impaired drivers, increasing numbers of which are incapacitated by drugs other than alcohol. The sheriff said his office now has two officers who have received extra training to detect drivers who have been using drugs ranging from illegal narcotics to abused prescription pills. He said the Decatur Police Department has about four such officers, and Mount Zion Police Department also has one officer. Now, if you had asked me how many drug recognition officers we have in the state of Illinois south of I-80 two or three years ago, it might have been two or three, he said. And while we've seen a bit of a decrease in the number of people drinking and driving, we've seen an increase in the amount of impaired driving by way of drugs, both prescription and opiate use. Schneider said increased police patrols, roadside spot checks, and other law enforcement efforts were working around the clock to get unsafe drivers off the road. You go out and drive impaired, we're going to put you in jail, he said. And that concludes that article. Skipping into a bit of the national news, something on the wire right now is Trump under fire for revealing classified information. So this is out of Washington, White House disputes report that secrets revealed to Russian officials. President Donald Trump revealed highly classified information about Islamic State militants to Russian officials during a meeting last week, the Washington Post reported on Monday, prompting strong condemnation from both Democrats and Republicans. Three White House officials who were in the May 10th meeting strongly denounced the story, saying no intelligence sources and methods were discussed, but they didn't deny that classified information was disclosed. Citing current and former U.S. officials, the Post said Trump shared details about an Islamic State terror threat related to the use of laptop computers on aircraft with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and the Russian Ambassador to the U.S., Sergei Kislyak. The anonymous officials told the Post that the information Trump relayed during the Oval Office meeting had been provided by a U.S. partner through an intelligence-sharing arrangement. They said it was considered so sensitive that details have been withheld from allies and tightly restricted even within the U.S. government. I was in the room and it did not happen, H.R. McMaster, Trump's national security advisor, told reporters outside the White House late Monday. The president and the foreign minister reviewed a range of common threats to our two countries, including threats to civil aviation, McMaster said. At no time were intelligence resources or methods discussed, and the president did not disclose any military operations that were not already publicly known. He said Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and Dina Powell, Deputy National Security Advisor for Strategy, remember the meeting the same way. Their on-the-record accounts should outweigh those of anonymous sources. In the news report, he said, Tillerson said Trump discussed a range of subjects, including common efforts and threats regarding counterterrorism. He said that during that exchange, the nature of specific threats were discussed, but they did not discuss sources, methods, or military operations. Powell said, "This story is false. The president only discussed the common threats that both countries faced." The Post story, which was later confirmed by the New York Times and BuzzFeed News, does not claim that Trump revealed any specific information about how the intelligence was gathered. Still, it will only heighten Trump's strained relations with intelligence workers and former officials who view Russia as an adversary. Even before he was inaugurated, intelligence professionals worried about sharing classified information with Trump, who often shoots from the hip. If true, the breach was ill-timed, coming a day after Trump fired former FBI Director James Comey, who was leading an investigation into Russian meddling in the presidential election. Trump's first national security advisor, Michael Flynn, was fired after he misled Vice President Mike Pence about conversations he had with Kislyak. It is unlikely that Trump has broken any law. As president, Trump has broad authority to declassify government secrets. The Post said the intelligence partner had not given the United States permission to share the material with Russian officials. By doing so, Trump would have jeopardized cooperation from an ally familiar with the inner workings of the Islamic State group and make other allies or even U.S. intelligence officials worry about sharing future top secret details with the president. Afterward, White House officials took steps to contain the damage, placing calls to the CIA and the National Security Agency, the newspaper said. The CIA and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence declined to comment Monday evening. Congressional Republicans and Democrats expressed concern about the report. GOP Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, told reporters that Trump What the Trump White House has got to do something soon to bring itself under control and order. The shame of it is there's a really good national security team in place, and there are good, productive things that are underway through them and through others, Corker said. But the chaos that is being created by the lack of discipline is creating an environment that I think makes it, that creates a worrisome environment. Senator John McCain, Republican out of Arizona, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, said, "We certainly don't want any president to leak classified information, but the president does have the right to do that." Reaction from Democrats on the House and Senate Intelligence Committees was full-throated. Representative Adam Schiff of California called the story deeply disturbing and said if it is true, this disclosure could jeopardize sources of very sensitive intelligence and relationships with key allies. That the Russians would be the potential recipients of this intelligence and may be able to determine its source is all the more problematic, since the Russian interest in Syria and elsewhere is in many respects deeply antithetical to our own, Schiff said. He added that he wants the House Intelligence Committee fully briefed on what, if anything, was shared with the Russian officials. Senator Mark Warner, Democrat from Virginia, tweeted, "If true, this is a slap in the face to the intel community. Risking sources and methods is inexcusable, particularly with the Russians." The story prompted Senator Martin Heinrich, Democrat from New Mexico, to tweet, "Pro tip, don't give the Russians classified information. #classified101. Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat out of Oregon, who had just had a root canal, read reporters a statement he scrawled out in the dentist chair after learning about the story. "These reports, if true, are of the gravest possible concern. It could harm our national security by cutting off important sources of intelligence that protect Americans against terrorist acts," Wyden said. The controversy engulfed the White House. Reporters spent much of the evening camped outside of Press Secretary Sean Spicer's office, hoping for answers. At one point, an eagle-eyed reporter spotted a handful of staffers, including Spicer and Deputy Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders, walking into the cabinet room. Muffled yelling was heard coming from the area near the room, but after a reporter tweeted about the noise, press staffers quickly turned up their television volume, blasting the sound to drown out everything else. And that concludes that article. Out of the money section comes an article local from Decatur, presented by Valerie Wells, and is titled, "Decatur Veterans Assistance Program to End." A local veterans assistance program is among the cuts that Lutheran Child and Family Services of Illinois announced Monday. The organization is restructuring its services following several years of financial challenges and changing needs, it said in a news release. Decatur's Veterans Assistance Program is one of nine programs that will close. About 100 positions, a quarter of the organization's total workforce, will be eliminated, it said. "This has been an agonizing decision, particularly due to the impact on our clients and their families, as well as our employees whose jobs were eliminated," LCFS President and CEO Mike Bertrand said in a news release. "We are refocusing our mission to what we as an agency are best at, which is serving traumatized children and their families as a child welfare organization." The Decatur Veterans Program launched in 2011. It worked together with D&O Properties 1 LLC toward a goal of providing housing for homeless veterans, as well as support services such as treatment of mental illness and substance abuse and vocational training. Lucy Brownlee, Special Projects Manager for D&O Properties, said it is sad to watch yet another important service shuttered due to lack of funds. "D&O will do its best to carry on, but a critical factor will be missing. The housing project to serve homeless veterans, which includes the North Street Commons Complex that opened in 2013, is almost at capacity, with 15 or 16 units occupied. The Decatur Housing Authority provides rent assistance, and DNO holds monthly meetings with the veterans. It's just they're losing the case management, the key piece, the third leg of the stool, as we call it, to making it a successful project, Brownlee said. They support our people so they can be stabilized and improve their lives. It's a very sad thing. That's the way I see it. The state government is watching as the most vital part of services are being shut down as a motivation to make us all cow under whatever budget they present. We are just at the mercy of the way the wind blows. This isn't the end of the veteran services, she said. The Salvation Army and the Coalition for Veterans Concerns, as well as the Veterans Assistance Commission, are still operating. All is not lost, but it sure is a dark day, Brownlee said. The Macon County Veterans Assistance Commission can only do so much, said David Frayling. There are a lot of homeless veterans in town, he said. Either we or somebody else will have to step up and help. We are kind of strapped as to what we can do. Timing to wind down each LCFS program depends on several factors, but all are expected to wrap up by the end of June. In addition to veterans assistance programs offered at the Decatur office, they include foster care, individual, marital, and family counseling, and family life education. And that concludes that article. And on a local note, I am going to read an article submitted by Justin Kahn, titled Our Story. Reporter finds the one to share I love you, and is submitted by Justin Kahn out of Playa del Carmen, Mexico. This weekend I got married, and right now I'm in Mexico enjoying my honeymoon with my new wife, so I won't be bringing you any stories about sick people, old houses, ghosts, honeysuckle, or golf. But I would like to share our story. Warning, if you're averse to sappy love stories, listen up and read this anyway. This first is my part about how we met and how the relationship progressed. The second is my wife Elizabeth's part about when I first told her I loved her. I came home late from having drinks at Pop's place, sat down on the couch, and clicked on the OK Cupid app. I honestly did not figure I was going to meet the one on any of these dating sites. I didn't even really believe in that anymore, but it was fun, and it got my mind off previous relationship failures. I saw someone had reviewed my profile. Her name was Elizabeth, and my eyes widened when I saw her. She was beautiful and remarkably stylish. Then I looked at her profile. She had taken the time to thoughtfully describe herself. All the words were spelled correctly. She was a writer. She listened to European music. Then I realized this had to be a mistake. She'd accidentally clicked on my profile. She had not messaged me or anything. Yeah, there was no way. But I'd had a few drinks, so I messaged her. Right? Why not? Wow, you are young and beautiful. I'm flattered that you even looked at my profile. If you want to get to know me, that would be great. If not, good luck in this crazy world of internet dating. She responded and we began messaging back and forth. Eventually, I asked her out, but she told me she'd already agreed to a date with someone else. Oh, well, it was fun while it lasted. The whole thing was kind of like window shopping anyway. But we kept talking. A couple days later, she told me that things had not worked out with her and the other guy and asked me if I wanted to meet for something to eat after I got off work. When I met her, she was as advertised. We talked for 3 hours. I couldn't believe she was interested in me. I kept waiting for someone to jump out and laugh at me for thinking this was real. I considered the possibility I was being catfished by someone creating a false online identity. I texted her later, keeping with the nothing-to-lose attitude, and told her she was beautiful. I awaited her polite but firm rejection, but instead she texted, "You're pretty handsome yourself." I was shocked. She liked me. Next, we had a date at Red Lobster. Whatever I was doing, it was working, and soon we were boyfriend and girlfriend. There were tough times both of us had walls that needed tearing down, but being with her made me a better, happier person. I could feel it. I've always considered myself intelligent, but what I quickly learned was that she was my match and more. She was classy, driven, generous, and sophisticated, traits I'd only dreamed of having. And for some reason, she loved me despite my lack of style, multiple neuroses, and crippling insecurities. That made me feel pretty special. She inspired me. She motivated me. She bluntly told me to get off my butt and change things when she had to. They say opposites attract, but it's not that simple. We were different, but we were compatible. I don't remember the moment I knew I loved her, but it became clear to me I had been wrong. There was the one, after all. Three little words. It was late. We were sitting on his worn leather couch, watching TV. We just finished laughing about something, lingering in that space where the laughter has stopped, but the sound still reverberates in your ears and the smile still twitches on your lips. "I love you, Liz," he blurted out. I almost replied with, "I love you too," but I caught myself, realizing the magnitude of what had just happened. This was the first time that he'd said he loved me, and the fact that I was so willing to reply with the same scared me. "You do? How do you know?" I heard myself asking. "I just do." And somewhere along the way, we'd fallen in love, and I had not even noticed. Only a few months before, after our first date, I remember thinking that this time was different, that he was different. But I had immediately dismissed the thought. How many times had I gone on a few dates with a guy and felt that he might actually be someone worth dating, only to be slapped in the face by a reality short time later? But with him, one date led to another, a few dates led to holding hands, hand-holding eventually led to a first kiss, and now, here I was, sitting in his apartment, hearing what I'd wanted someone to say to me for so long, and I was afraid to take the leap and let him know how I felt. I mentally wrestled with what it all meant. Would things somehow change between us because of these three little words? In that moment, all I could do was hug him, because I did not know what to say. I hoped that my embrace would translate all of the thoughts that were flying through my mind, that the way I felt about him would somehow come through the tips of my fingers, travel through his body, and rest upon his heart. Hours later, I looked over and said, "I love you too." "I know," he said. "I could tell. I wouldn't have said it if I didn't think so." And then he kissed me on the forehead and told me good night. And that was a beautiful story from Justin Kahn and his new bride, Elizabeth. They are celebrating their honeymoon in Mexico for all you people who still have hope. All right, we are going to start wrapping up part one of the Decatur Herald and Review, dated May 16th, 2017. I'm going to take a short break. My name is Linda, and I hope that you will return in just a few minutes to hear part two of the Decatur Herald and Review.